Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
I am indeed privileged and to be speaking today with John Feerick, a professor of law at Fordham Law School, and actually a former dean at the school, and the author of a number of important books, including a book that has been seen in three different editions called The 25th Amendment, Its Complete History and Applications. This is the constitutional amendment that involves when a president finds himself or herself unable to fulfill the duties of the office, the provisions by which the vice president steps in, and other provisions beyond that. John Feerick had a major hand in the crafting of that 25th Amendment, that is, its language. And one of the most interesting chapters of this book is about that experience. But he goes on to explore some other issues, including that of the Electoral College, the whole art of conflict resolution, the whole realm of public service, and his long, many years as a very, very busy lawyer. And the book is also a memoir of his life as a youngster, his family, his background, his Irish heritage, and much, much more. It is a richly fascinating book published by Fordham University Press. It's titled That Further Shore, A Memoir of Irish Roots and American Promise. And John D. Feerick, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your introduction.
I am really impressed and also in a sense kind of exhausted, as I should think maybe you were, in the writing of a book that is so broad in its approach. That is, there is so much here, everything from a deeply personal sort of memoir to chapters that are devoted to some of the most complicated professional undertakings of your career. When you began writing this book, did you intend it to be this kind of broad and complex canvas, or did it just sort of become that?
Yes, I had not intended it. my focus at the time I began to give consideration of the book was on my parents, who had died 10 years before, and their immigrant heritage, which passed along to me and my siblings. I was the firstborn in the United States, so my focus was very much on my family. But as I got into it, I realized that very, very important to their lives when they came to the United States as young teenagers. Was the family that they gave birth to, and I was their oldest child, and owed so much to them, and certainly my existence and my heritage, my faith, and I realized that focusing on myself had to become a part of the book, because that was center to their lives and having children and raising us and talking about going to grammar school and high school. Neither of them had gone to high school, and the stress on education. So that's how we got there. And as it went along, over almost 20 years, I began to think maybe I should have a chapter on this, have a chapter on that. A common denominator for a lot of those chapters is the idea of service, and I inherited that, you might say, from my parents and my teachers, and never did I think that it would be as long as it is. Mm-hmm. And the idea of doing 3 books, which was somebody mentioned to me along the way, was a non-starter for me. As I was approaching 80 years of age, I started the project when I was close to 70, and I figured, well, let me put it all together in one book and then try to make it as cohesive as I could.
I think you've managed that pretty darn well. I do want to talk for a moment. I do want to talk for a moment about your parents, whom you refer to in the book as Mom and Pop, and you describe their background in Ireland. And at one point, towards the very end of part one of the book, you write, "As Mom and Pop grew into adulthood and looked to the future, the effects of the conflict between England and Ireland remained a constant, and there were no jobs for young people when they came of age other than working on the family farm. As a result, both Mom and Pop decided as teenagers to do something profoundly different. They set their sight on a land 3,000 miles away, one they envisioned as a place of opportunity and promise." You go on to say your mom left Ireland in 1928, and then your dad and his brother, your Uncle Pat, left the year later. I appreciate the fact that you help us understand what would prompt them to make such a drastic decision, and you also describe in painstaking detail what it was like once they got here. It was a life that was not particularly easy, and yet it became a very rich life, which they ultimately loved.
Yeah, I would say you captured it very, very, very well. And when my mother arrived, we had the first Catholic nominee of a major party, Al Smith, running for the presidency. She came in the spring of 1928. When my father arrived a year later, the new president, Herbert Hoover, had taken the oath of office, and the economy was about to plunge into the Great Depression. And certainly historic times, and yet each of them found work in different contexts, and they met it at some point in the early 1930s. And my mother lost her sister at that time, a younger sister. She was never to see again when she came to America, and she went to visit some relatives of her family in Chicago, and came back, and they resumed their relationship. And thanks to them, I became their firstborn.
One thing that is so interesting is that we read about your childhood, a very ordinary childhood in many respects that involved being a faithful Catholic and a kid who loved stickball and a mom who loved cook and so on. I mean, it's a very normal working class kind of childhood. At what point did the notion occur to you that you might be destined for something like a career in law? I mean, what in a sense inspired you to set your sights as high as you ultimately did?
I after graduating from high school, where I had a mixed record academically, and the first half of high school it was rough going for me, and the second half I seemed to pick up some steam academically. and I got to Fordham College and got very much involved in student government activities at Fordham College, and I was a political science major. I got exposed to the Constitution and subjects having to do with political science. But as to a career in the law, it was very late in my time at Fordham College that I began to focus on that as an alternative. I had considered even at that point whether I had a vocation to the priesthood or the brother, you might say the brotherhood, religious brother, since I was educated by both groups. I enjoyed very much working in a supermarket, and I did that throughout my college years, working on weekends during the summer full time, and I enjoyed very much the community of a supermarket. And it was in a minority area of New York City. I loved the people we were dealing with. And I learned about hard work. I learned about having a product that was important to sell, namely the supermarket. And I was encouraged to become pursue an executive management training program, which I gave serious thought to at one point. But as I got to the point of having to leave Fordham College, I didn't have any job necessarily, other than staying and being involved in the alumni activities of Fordham. I began to think about whether law might be where I should go, because I had developed, as a result of my student government activities, a lot of interest in government, and I saw the law as possibly a place where one with that education, you know, might be able to make, in my case, his way. And we had a television series at the time, Perry Mason, lawyer in the courtroom, and I saw the Constitution tied to law as well, and I think those sort of dawned on me and. At some point during my last year, that I should apply to law school, and I was accepted to two law schools, and chose to go to Fordham, which was so much a part of my psychology. Having been a Fordham College student, and I'd heard about some of the people at the law school, and it turned out to be that those 3 years at the law school a major part of my life. I did well as a law student. I wrote comments or notes on the Constitution for the Fordham Law Review, and so when I graduated from law school, and I didn't have any vision of where I was going, to be frank with you. I joined a small law firm where I felt that I could be very comfortable in the smallest of a firm. It ultimately became a very big firm, but that's over 20, 30 years.
Right.
And I wanted to continue my writing, my law review writing, on some phase of the Constitution, and I saw the subject of presidential disability. And I said, gee, I don't know why that's an issue. And I said to myself, well, let me study that and write an article on it. And so I wrote that article over the next 2.5 years. I was in the Army for a while during that period, and wherever I had extra time, I studied presidential succession systems, one might say, And in October of '63, when I the article was published, I sent it around to some of the newspaper journalists who were writing on the subject of inability, to scholars and historians. I sent a reprint to President Kennedy, to his brother Robert Kennedy, who was Attorney General, and to their brother, Ted Kennedy, who was in the Senate at that time. And I'm thinking, well, let me see if I can get interest in the subject. It had been a subject of interest during the Eisenhower years, but it seemed to decline in interest as it moved into the 1960s. So we had a young, able, healthy president, but I have become passionate about the subject.
Right.
And never did I realize, as a result of having written the article, I would be invited to participate essentially in the crafting of the constitutional amendment. I never saw that as something that would actually happen to me. I just wanted to persuade others to do something about the problem.
Absolutely. We're speaking with John DeFerrick about his book, That Further Shore, A Memoir of Irish Roots and American Promise. And since you've taken us to the topic of presidential succession, let's dig into this for just a little bit. I want to read an excerpt from the article that was published on November 17th, 1963. I want to make sure our listeners take note of that date. This is a part of what you wrote in that article. Presidents are mortal. President Garfield's shooting, President Wilson's stroke, and President Eisenhower's heart attack rendered the respective president temporarily unable to exercise the powers and duties of his office. Despite this, Congress has consistently failed the American people by not acting to eliminate the possibility of a gap in the executive because of the confusion existing over the meaning of the succession provision of the Constitution. Help us understand what was, in a sense, left unsaid or left unspecified in the U.S. Constitution, which, in a sense, left us up in the air in these moments when a president, as you have just described on several different occasions in our history, was essentially disabled. What did the U.S. Constitution fail to say about that?
When the Constitution was being formulated, the idea of having a presidential succession provision was introduced as a necessary provision, as it had been in the some of the state constitutions dealing with the office of governor, and so they came up with a provision, and which you can read in Article 2 of the Constitution, Section 1, Clause 6. And at some point during the framing of the Constitution, one of the delegates, Dickinson, from Delaware, says, well, "What do we mean by inability? And who is to judge it?" So his questions were not answered, and nothing was done about that in terms of the questions he asked. And those two questions became exceedingly important as the country started to develop. It also left unclear by the actual wording of Article 2, Section 1, Clause 6, was exactly what was the status of a vice president who took over the powers and duties of the office, whether in a case of death, resignation, removal, or inability. Those were the four contingencies that were put in the Constitution. What is the status of a vice president? So we moved along in our nation's history until we had the first case of a death of a president in office, William Harrison. He was president for a very short time, probably no more than a month, and he died. And the vice president, John Tyler, said, "I'm now the new president." And there was some members of the Congress said, "Well, no, you're an acting president, and your title should reflect that, vice president acting as president." And basically he said, "That's nonsense." He said, "There's a vacancy in the office for the rest of the term, and I'm going to take the oath and a president and serve as the new president of the United States term." As I say, some members of Congress said, That's not the correct interpretation of that provision. And including John Quincy Adams, who served in the House of Representatives at that time, and it was accepted. Subsequent to that, when a few presidents died, including President Lincoln, the vice president took over as the president for the rest of the term, following the Tyler president. However, we ran into a problem in 1881 when Garfield was shot, and he would die 80 days later. But during the period that they were trying to deal with the assassination, he was hovering between life and death, and people called on the vice president to do something, to take over. That's the last thing he wanted to do. And the cabinet met to talk about encouraging the vice president to take over, and they really didn't have any clarity on the issue of one, if he took over, the vice president, would he be the president for the rest of the term, even if Garfield recovered from the disability. Some said yes, he'd be president for the rest of the term, regardless of whether the president recovered from his disability, and it was a sort of like a quagmire how to deal with it. And so they did nothing, and then 80 days later, the president died, and Arthur spent almost all of his time in New York, and that was to be repeated when Wilson had a stroke. And clearly unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office for a good period of time, maybe for the rest of his term, and that seems well established at this point. And once again, the vice president said that, look, Wilson was his friend, and he really wasn't going to try to take over, even though members of the cabinet had encouraged them to do so. And one member who was particularly encouraging, when the president learned about that, subsequent to that, he dismissed him from the cabinet.
Wow. You know, it's so interesting to think about how, in a sense, we were, it was so much according to sort of the temperament of the vice president at hand. I mean, for instance, William Henry Harrison dies in 1841. His vice president, John Tyler, boldly steps into the office of president without any hesitation, it would seem. On the other hand, Thomas Marshall, the vice president of Woodrow Wilson, seems to have been a much more hesitant individual, and in his deference to President Wilson, failed to step in as probably a lot of people believed he needed to at that important moment. And so I guess what you're describing a situation in which what would happen in such situations was entirely dependent upon who was in these positions and what they felt comfortable with, rather than being able to follow the word of the law and to have a very clear word of law as the guidance in a moment like that.
The one issue that still lurked was that one might make the case that that Tyler, in a case of death, perhaps should have taken it all the way to the end as he did, and on the other hand, in the case of Wilson, would Marshall's succession have been for the rest of the term of Wilson, who some indication that maybe some months before the end of his term he was able to function as the president in terms of powers and duties. However, if the Tyler precedent was followed, he wouldn't be able to do that. And if you read Article 2 of the Constitution, you see all those contingencies tied together. It talks about the removal, death, resignation, or inability. And it says that the same shall devolve on the vice president. So the interpretation that was given to the same Shell Devolve on the vice president was that the vice president, in any of those cases, including inability, one could say, took over for the rest of the term.
Hmm. So describe to our listeners the kind of work that you and your colleagues did in the 1960s in terms of forging language for what would ultimately become an amendment to the Constitution. You describe in your book some long conversations and discussions and debates and so on. What sorts of things were kind of the sticking points or the kind of details that needed to be worked out with a question that on the surface might seem rather simple, but in fact was much more complicated the longer you looked at it?
Yes, certainly. Let me just push it back just a few years. During the Eisenhower administration, Eisenhower on three different occasions suffered an inability. And in that time period, he supported the idea of a constitutional amendment. The chair of the House Judiciary Committee, even before the president's Eisenhower's inability, wanted to take a look at this subject because of the earlier history with Wilson and Arthur, and we're in a different era now. An era of atom bomb and all kinds of other security issues. So Eisenhower thought that Congress needed to deal with the subject, and one of the questions was, you're dealing with the Constitution. How do we deal with a case of a president who had become physically or mentally disabled, and how should we trigger the amendment? Could the president trigger the amendment by declaring that he needed to go in for an operation and therefore needed to turn over the powers and duties to the vice president, and then what happens if the president was unconscious and didn't have a chance to turn over his powers and duties? Who should declare he's disabled? Where do we give that power? Do we give the power to the Congress to decide? Congress to decide and set up a process to deal with that? Or should we have in the amendment itself the detail that spells out the process? So, because Congress may do nothing with it, what should the amendment look like? There were those who said it should be just very general, clarify that the vice president takes over during a disability only, and there were others that said that leave it to Congress to decide under that amendment, give Congress the power to decide what kind of body to have. Should you have a commission, some other, have the Supreme Court? You know, what is it that Congress should be in, not the Constitution, but within the power of Congress? So you had the issue of the involvement of Congress, how far should Congress go, and then you might say the integrity of the executive branch of government.
Mm.
Go ahead.
I'd like you to also comment on the matter of the 48-hour amendment that was kind of part of the discussion. And it looks like that was a real interesting bone of contention that I think a lot of people know nothing about. Explain what the concern was around that and some of the other time limits that ultimately became part of this.
Yeah, there was a lot of, as you point out correctly so, in the amendment that started to get shaped during the Eisenhower administration, you didn't have a lot of detail. But what you did have is the overarching idea of the president being able to declare his own disability, and the idea of the vice president and the cabinet having an important role where the president couldn't declare his own disability, and that was really in the framework of the Eisenhower administration. So when Senator Birch Bayh, who became the principal, you might say, author of the amendment, although the two houses of Congress and members of the House of Congress played a very, very important, you would have no constitutional amendment if it weren't two houses. So, but Senator Birch Bayh started to focus on filling in some of the details. You have questions of, for example, the president sends a declaration to Congress, and what does that mean? Who does the declaration go to? And they ended up with the originally they ended up with the speaker and the president of the Senate. And then they realized, well, wait a minute, the president of the Senate is the vice president. And so if power is with the vice president of the cabinet to declare a president disabled, the vice president essentially is sending that declaration over to himself. So they came with the words, the past to be the president pro tem. Now, then they said, well, if Congress is going to have to be involved in a situation where the vice president and the cabinet say that the president is disabled, and the president doesn't agree with that, how do you resolve that disagreement? You've got to go to Congress. You had senators like Senator Ervin and others and I even think maybe the majority leader at the time were very much concerned about putting a limit on any debate in the Senate, and so they had wording about, well, let's we have to immediately decide the issue of inability. You can't drag if it goes to Congress, and then others said, well, wait a minute. There may be other things that Congress has to deal with at that point. And what do we mean by in immediately?
Mm.
So they started to wordsmith the amendment at that point.
You know, it's so interesting. It's so interesting. It really helps us understand how immensely complicated the crafting of just about anything of this nature is, but particularly something like this where you're trying to think about what contingencies to cover and how things should be worded, how specifically or how generally. And of course, you could come at those kind of questions with different philosophies, different points of reference. And it makes all of this incredibly difficult. But it sounds like ultimately the consensus was reached maybe more quickly and more painlessly than we would imagine such a discussion happening, for instance, today.
Well, let me just leaving today aside for a second. The idea of putting a limit on the whole issue of the president saying I'm able and the vice president of the cabinet saying you're not able. Now it's in Congress, And what does Congress do with it? And they also contemplated that the in the meantime the vice president is acting as president. So you got the vice president acting as president, and you got it in Congress to decide who's right or wrong on that. And so the House came with the idea there needed to be a time limit. Congress has to act right away. And if initial proposal 10 days. And Senator Bayh and his colleagues in the Senate had to decide, do we get away from this immediately language and come up with a time provision? And they agreed to 21 days, and the House had 10 days on the table, and they eventually came to an agreement on the 21 days. Then the question was, from what point do you measure the 21 days? If the Congress is out of session, is that where the issue was presented as a result of the disagreement communication to Congress. So Congress is out of session. Do you start counting the 21 days from when the declaration was sent to Congress, or do you count the 21 days when Congress assembles to decide it? And that's how the 48-hour days provision got in. It said, no, Congress has to assemble, and that came from the Speaker of the House of Representatives, John McCormick. Most people would not know that because he didn't step up publicly on the floor of the House. But I have a communication that I made reference to in my book Richard Poff, key person in Congress in the House, presenting the subject, telling me that in a letter that the Speaker had suggested that. And so where do you measure it? So they had to redo the words to say if Congress is out of session, it got to meet within 48 days. There was some concern, well, what if it doesn't meet within 48 days? What happens then? But let's leave that a question for a second. So Congress has to meet in 48 days, and you start measuring the 21 days that required Congress to deal with the subject from that point, not from the point when there's a communication when Congress is out of session. So that's how the how that was dealt with, and you know, so and it was interesting. As a young person at the time, I was having a lot of communications with the Senator Bayh's staff, and also with Richard Poff, who played such a major role. And I do talk about that in my book, as you know. And
yes.
But going back to your earlier question. I had foggiest idea I would be involved in any of this when I wrote that article, and I didn't have any dream when I came out of college, other than possibly getting involved in either two areas: one as politics, local politics, whatever it might be, or becoming a teacher, And because of my involvement in this amendment, I began to realize that maybe my purpose in life was to have law reform.
Mm.
And I'm an independent voter, I'm an independent guy, and I because of the 25th Amendment, it really turned me into believing that this was important, that you know, to work on law reform. It doesn't have to. Obviously, I wasn't thinking about the Constitution as such, but I did have the opportunity to work with Senator Bayh and many of the same people on the Electoral College Amendment, and I spent a lot of years on that as well. So
I wanted to mention. I wanted to mention that the fact that I think some people would be surprised that there was such serious work on the question of abolishing the Electoral College as early as 1966, maybe earlier, but that's when you were a part of this. And actually, you were part of a commission that ultimately recommended the abolition of the Electoral College. Just in a nutshell, it sounds like this is something that you believe in. That is, you believe that there is something intrinsically unfair about the Electoral College. Can you explain the heart of your concern about that?
Sure. I was in 1966, as the 25th Amendment was being processed in the ratification period, and it would go into the Constitution in February 67. The ABA set up a commission. A lot of former presidents of the American Bar Association. From Montana, from Georgia, and I was asked to be the special advisor to the commission. So I learned about the Electoral College system, and what was compelling to that commission and the outcome was the importance of every person having an equal right to elect the president, not simply in an indirect way, but in a direct way, and so they recommended abolish the Electoral College Why was it important at that time? Because George Wallace was seeking, as a third-party candidate, electoral votes from states that where his appeal was a popular one, as a way of preventing the major party candidates, the Democratic Republican candidates, having a majority, which then would have thrown the election into the House of Representatives, where every state has one vote, and for the Vice President, the Senate would have to choose. But he also had a plan to possibly ask his electors to vote when the Electoral College met, which would be meeting in all the different states, to vote for one of the major party candidates that perhaps he would have understood would support his plans going forward. So, and both major parties responded very negatively to that effort, and supported the idea of major reform. The House of Representatives, by an almost 80%, supported that amendment. The Senate had, I think, about 60 senators, but they couldn't break the filibuster, so it failed.
I want to just read something that you said in your own testimony at the time. You write, "I would want to believe that my vote for you was equal in weight to that of any other citizen of the United States in any other area of the United States. It seems to me that if there were people like myself of a particular point of view, that we should all be entitled to cast an equal vote with reference to the expression of that point of view." I appreciate that the chapter of this book explores some of the other issues involved in that. In our closing minutes, I want to circle.
Can I just make a statement on that?
Yeah.
I have a child in California. I have another child in North Carolina. I have another child in Ohio. I have another child in Maryland. And then I have two children in New York. And my children in different parts of the country have their children. And so just as one family, it is sort of ironic that we really don't have that equal vote because of the everybody, we're not the same. One of those states might be a state that always goes one way. The other state might be, in terms of the Electoral College vote, go the other way. It does seem, and I think increasingly many American families are having their children spread across the country. And shouldn't we all be the same in terms of the right to vote for a president?
Seems simple. In our closing couple of minutes, I want to just touch briefly on something else that has been a facet of your professional life, and that is mediation, conflict resolution, which has been important work that you have done with organizations like the NBA and the NFL and the Democratic Convention, the Republican Convention, and all kinds of other scenarios in which you have stepped in as a mediator, and in sometimes situations that were very, very difficult. I wish we had longer to talk about this, but just in a couple of minutes, how would you summarize your central principles in terms of being a successful mediator in the midst of really difficult conflicts? What have been your guiding principles?
Thank you for the question. Sometimes I've not been successful. I have to point that out. But what's particularly a guiding is helping the parties to understand where each is coming from. And so respect for the parties and whatever their positions might be, being neutral. And as you help parties communicate with each other, that where they might not be able to communicate without the assistance of a third party, such as a mediator, you might raise with them, either in separate sessions or jointly, options that might be that might be available to them, as Roger Fisher and others have said, that talking about peeling an orange, and where two people are fighting over the orange. If you peel the orange, it may turn out that one wants to eat what's inside and the other really wants the skin. And so the more you get to understand the needs and interests of parties, and you broaden the conversation, you have a better chance perhaps of helping them resolve their problems.
Mm. Here's a last question for you. This comes from much earlier in the book, when you say that I brought to my life as a lawyer a varied employment history. And you touched on that briefly already, on some of the jobs that you had, including working in a grocery store, delivering clothes, stocking shelves, and various other endeavors. You did a whole lot of different things. And what kind of difference do you think that made, as opposed to somebody who comes from a very privileged background where they hardly have to work a day in their life until the day they graduate from law school and become a lawyer? You had a very different upbringing. And what kind of difference do you think that made in terms of the kind of lawyer you have been and the other professional endeavors for which you are so well known?
Well, thank you. Thank you for that question. I guess because of the variety of things that I became involved in growing up, and also as a lawyer, I saw people in a lot of different contexts, and I began to and I had, I guess you could say, a more social engagement orientation to myself, and I treated everyone not as a boss, but as you know, as a partner in a process or in a setting. It could be a supermarket where I play my role and hope that they trust me enough as a result of seeing and understanding who I am to share with me perspectives that might be important for the resolution of a matter. And it's not just the United States. I went over to Ghana in 2010, and I was invited over by the clergy, and the Catholic clergy in that part of that country, if I could help them develop a conflict resolution center to resolve disputes of all kinds that might develop in that population. And I went over and got to know them. Did that over several years with many other people. I was just, one of a group that, where I guess my involvement was trying to put the group together, and they wanted to know about mediation and principles of neutrality and principles of ethics and conflicts of interest. You don't hide conflicts of interest. You parties need to know what your possible conflicts might be. So treating people fairly and listening to them with empathy, all of that, I suppose, I learned in my home. And I saw my parents and how they dealt with that discipline in the family. I saw that in my neighborhood. And I try to share as much of that as I can, as you know, in the book.
Mm. I'm glad all of that is there. It is a really interesting book, wide-ranging, and we learn so much about you and about life and about the world and about how things have changed and the abiding things that stay the same. The book, again, is titled That Further Shore, A Memoir of Irish Roots and American Promise. And the book is published by Fordham University Press, and the author, John Feerick. John Feerick, it's been a great honor for me to speak with you on the morning show. And thank you for giving the world this a very interesting book. And thank you for all that you've done for the world and for our country.
I want to thank you very much for your interest and kindness in arranging this meeting.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com.